Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Daisha Eaton of KSKA, and Kyle Hopkins of the Anchorage Daily News. The United States Supreme Court issues two rulings on gay marriage. One of them applies to only the state of California. The other will have effects all over the country and including Alaska. Paul, what does the 5-4 ruling on DOMA mean here in the 49th state?
It means that even here where marriage has been defined as a union between a man and a woman, if you are married in a state, a same-sex marriage, if that marriage takes place in a state where it's legal, the federal government in Alaska will recognize that marriage for certain benefits. Unespousal unemployment, federal health care. The military will treat you here like they would treat any other married couples. There's all sorts of other areas that have yet to be resolved. It's like a morass right now of what is and what isn't. How do you decide who's married and who's not? The military and certain federal agencies, they look at things called a place of celebration where you were married. Then they have places of residence, and that counts for certain benefits. It's going to be a long, hard road to get this ironed out as to what applies to whom and how. It's going to take years and lawsuits. The president has wide latitude.
One thing that was really interesting, the writer in the New York Times pointed out that no rabbi, minister, or priest now decides if you're legally married. That's it's right. Decided by a state line, which is certainly unusual, to say the least.
Well, as we were talking before the show, you can file your federal income taxes, but not be as a couple, but can't file your state income taxes as a couple. All of that's going to be sorted out. It's going to be a couple of years. 25 days from now, when this law goes into effect, will be the start of a long, grinding process.
And we should remember that this case, while a benefits case, it was addressed to the federal benefits that gay couples or gay individuals might receive. The ruling, especially from Anthony Kennedy, the language he used had tremendous reverberation with the gay community and great symbolism, right?
I think it's probably for them the most symbolic ruling yet. I think before this is over, they're going to be integrated into society just like everybody else. It's just going to be a long process to get there.
Okay. Kyle, gathering signatures for the referendum on Governor Parnell's legislation altering oil taxes hasn't exactly been a combat sport, but we have seen some pretty spirited exchanges out there where people are gathering signatures from pro and con.
Sure. I think we're all used to, you know, if you buy a book in Anchorage, I think you're used to at certain times of the year expecting to see one or two guys with clipboards outside trying to get you to sign some petition. That's at least since I've lived here, that's always been the case. What's different this year
at the big chain stores?
At the big chain stores, when you go to Barnes and Noble, or you go to REI. But what's different this year is you have the petitioner, and then you also have this counter petitioner who is holding a sign or a placard who's telling you not to sign that petition. You know, or saying, hey, you don't really want to sign that, and here's why. And that's what's new, and that's something that probably hasn't been done, at least on any organized way in Alaska before. And it's happening because Art Hackney, who's a political consultant, and he's known for being a Republican strategist, for being kind of working on business causes. But I think some people would also be surprised to know that he also is kind of one of the main strategists to stop Pebble Mine development. You know, so there's
Bob Gillum is his client, or maybe there's a large umbrella of organized people, let's say.
Art Hackney has worked for many years, you know, on the anti-Pebble Mine movement, right? So that might surprise people who are now learning that he's also paying people like $15 an hour to stop this effort to repeal the oil tax overhaul, right? And so he says that he and his wife are paying maybe a half a dozen and are willing to pay up to 20 people to just in here in Fairbanks and maybe other places just kind of stand beside these petitioners and give a counterpoint. And where you have a problem and where the police have been called is when the petitioners say that the counter petitioners are crossing the line, that they're putting their kind of hands on the shoulder of someone who's about to sign the petition saying, hey, you don't really want to do that, kind of making physical contact. Which police have looked into and said
what did the police find when they arrested him?
The police just showed up. So that complaint for that type of activity was made on a Monday, and then a few days later, the police showed up and said, "Okay, we'll take a look at this." And the officer who did that said that he didn't see anything like that. that he talked to the security guard in Barnes & Noble who didn't see that, you know, specifically. But no one's been charged. No one's gotten in trouble. And the two sides are just pointing fingers at each other saying, well, no, that the other guy, he's the one who's really, you know, getting in people's way and kind of keeping them from getting in the bookstore. And I'm just here to educate people. Sides are saying that.
What does the bookstore have to say? Or for that, it could be any big business where signatures are gathered.
They say that, you know, those people have a right to be there up to a point as long as they're not kind of interfering with customers getting in and out. And one thing that I thought was interesting about Hackney, what he said about his what he's trying to do is he argues that people sometimes sign these petitions just because you don't want to deal with that petitioner, that you just want to get in the store and just say, okay, I'll sign that, and then you move on. So he's arguing that, like, it's a better use of his money than buying ads on the radio to actually have someone else trying to block those petitions, because people are just inclined to sign them, and he thinks that the petitioners are going to get enough signatures.
And from from the Hackney point of view, they would like to stop this from getting on the ballot, and that would be a better use of their money. If they could stop it now, then having to run a huge campaign involving perhaps $10 million or whatever it might take, right?
Right. Well, I mean, what he told me was that this seemed like a good, you know, bang for the buck as opposed to running ads. Although he is soliciting money for ads, or he's been trying to get people to run ads, specifically trying to press Senator Mark Begich on this issue, trying to make Begich take, you know, come out publicly saying either I'm for the current, you know, the tax overhaul, or I'm for the petition.
Has Begich said nothing, or has he said something like this is a state issue, or what's he said?
I don't think he's publicly made a statement.
I can see he wouldn't want to get in this. Is there any way to measure how cost-effective this approach is?
I don't think so. Another thing that Hackney did was he started a website called I Made a Mistake. I think it's imademistake.org. And I assume that was a clearinghouse for these type of petitions, but it's just for this petition. And so you go to that website.
I thought it was going to be a dating site with a name like that.
Right, he can probably sell that URL afterwards to any number of clients. But you can go on there and you can theoretically sign up to have a form sent to the Lieutenant Governor's office saying, hey, I want you to take my name off that petition that I already signed.
Okay. Paul, any additional thoughts on this?
No, I mean, I understand where he's coming from. We've got 18 months now of industry uncertainty as this thing unfolds. And I think he will get the signatures he needs by, mid-July, 30,000. I think he just wants to cut that process short. I understand what he's doing. I just don't think he's going to be successful.
Yeah, I did talk to one of the organizers of the petition drive, and they think that they're in good shape for getting the signatures, but they also are concerned about they have to get them in 30 of the 40 electoral districts, and that's proving to be, you know, some logistical headaches for them. Okay, another Anchorage resident dies in a violent encounter with the Anchorage Police Department, Dacia. Dacia and Kyle, you've both been covering this, so let's start with Dacia. What's happened in the case of Kenneth John?
Well, the police synopsis goes that they pulled Kenneth John over in kind of the Fairview near downtown area. And the 26-year-old got out of the SUV he was driving, approached the officer with, quote, two bladed weapons. They're not saying what these weapons were at this point. And the officer was by himself, and he fired a gun at John, and they took him to the hospital where he was pronounced dead. So the family is seeing things differently. They had a vigil on Thursday. This happened Monday. About 100 people showed up.
And where was this? Was it outdoors?
Outdoors, yeah, just curbside. It was near the corner of 12th and Hyder. And, people from the
Fairview.
Neighborhood showed up. Fairview area, yes. And people showed up. They sang some songs. They read some scripture. And a second cousin, his name I believe was Leonard James, I have a quote from him, and he says, this is no longer a family problem, this is a community problem. And he really called on the community to stand up to these shootings that have been happening so frequently. We've had 5 this year. I believe, Kyle, you reported that in the past year and a half there have been 10 or so. And he asked witnesses to come forward and talk with an attorney, which I hadn't heard anything about before. So that's kind of where things are now. They're planning a potlatch in his John's home village of Grayling for this weekend, and they're hoping to bury
him. And one
him.
More thing, hasn't there been some argument that, or some discussion, especially with people coming in from the bush, they're used to having weapons in their car, they're used to having a more neighborly, for lack of a better word, relationship with the police department. The police officer might be their cousin. Sometimes that's a problem.
Right.
But they have a different relationship with the law.
Yeah, and it's different. It's an urban environment here. We know that out-migration from the villages has been going on for some time. We may want to look at this. I haven't asked the police chief about this, but I plan to. There could be some cultural issues playing into this. Rural culture versus urban culture, native culture versus Western culture.
Okay, Kyle, I would say the entire Anchorage public would like to know if these kind of deaths are becoming more common and if there is an explanation.
Just to follow up on that thought about folks coming from the bush. I mean, I think it's worth noting that, we read these trooper reports every day from rural Alaska. And then sometimes you're reading about someone kind of brandishing a weapon in a village. That happens a lot. And in some of those villages, there is no police. So there's no one who would, force that encounter. Right, but to answer your question, like Dacia said, they're
a VPSO just got shot recently.
A VPSO just got shot. I'm sorry, I forget the name of the village, but it was in a pretty confrontation. It was in a prolonged, standoff at a home. But to answer your question, this is the fifth officer involved shooting in Anchorage this year. There were five last year, and five was considered kind of a bad year in that regard. And this is the third person who's been killed by city police. So what was surprising in this case is pretty quickly it became clear that these two people that John was connected to the previous person who was shot. On his Facebook page, there were pictures of him. He clearly was at a memorial for Detlef Wolf, and his family acknowledged that they were cousins, and that he'd made memorial signs and his stepfather said that John's stepfather, the man who was recently killed, said that he really internalized and was kind of rocked by the death of his cousin two blocks away 2 months earlier. As to why there are so many police-involved shootings, I think, one, it's worth noting that the numbers overall are small. So, two versus five versus six, I mean, it's,
they're high profile every time they happen, whatever the number is, right?
Right. The police chief says that he believes that there has been an increase, and he points to a UAA study that, along this regard, that says that over the past decade, people have just been more willing to assault police officers or kind of engage in a violent confrontation with police officers. And he said that as more people push the envelope, it stands to reason that they cross the line, and then police end up shooting somebody. And as a result, they recently announced a policy change that was kind of designed specifically to kind of reduce the number of times that police are firing their weapons on people. And that was when they said, we're not going to shoot at moving vehicles. If there's a driver in a car and they're maybe trying to ram their way out of a police barricade, if they don't have a gun, we're not going to shoot them, which they have in the past.
No, and of course, police officers have extensive training on approaching a vehicle that they've stopped for whatever reason. There's a car parked in front of them where they've pulled somebody over. They're trained in how to approach a vehicle, but on the other hand, they don't expect somebody to get out with a weapon, although they do know it can happen, and it has.
I think we'll be very interested to hear more just about the details from the police about the context of this traffic stop. Like, why was he stopped? Did he say anything? The officer apparently, according to police, the officer kind of retreated to the back of his car and told him in some way, issued some command, either drop the gun or stop moving, and then fired on him. But did John say anything?
But we don't know, because the police have been very tight-lipped about this case. Obviously, it is high profile. We don't even know exactly what the weapons were. But I think it's worth noting, Kyle, that there is an overall review of their policy on shooting. And there should be changes. I mean, not just shooting, but handling handling any kind of confrontations with people. They're going to be reviewing this and making some changes probably in the fall, the chief said, not just to moving vehicle shootings, but shootings and other encounters with people and violence.
They've been under fire since last year in that regard when Shane Tossey was shot and he approached an officer with a, I forget what it turned out to be.
They said it was a stick.
It was a broom handle or a stick.
Broken broom handle or something like that.
Right. And there were a lot of people who said there were a lot of questions at that time. Can't you wound that person instead of shooting them? Can't you wait until backup arrives? You know, do you have to shoot someone if they are not coming at you with a gun? And that discussion has been going on for a year and a half now, maybe, and this is really going to dial it up.
Yeah, and at the time, that I think the community viewed as a terrible anomaly, right? I mean, this was very unusual. And now we have several other events that aren't that much different, right?
Right. Well, you have the three within 5 months, which I don't know how many people have been killed by police in previous years, but you know, between 2008 and 2011, there were no more than three officer-involved shootings, and of course, most of those were not fatal.
I looked back to 1998, and five is the highest number last year and this year of any of
in
those.
What, in an individual year?
In an individual year, okay. Yes.
Let's move on. Paul, the United States Supreme Court strikes down part of the Voting Rights Act. Alaska was included under VRA. What does this mean for Alaska?
Well, the Supreme Court struck down Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. It's a victim of its own success. Section 5 required the state and eight other states to get federal permission or preclearance for even minor changes in voting procedures. Section 4 was how states found themselves under the jurisdiction of Section 5. And Section 4 dealt with specific things like voting habits, registration, and the law itself. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court found that essentially what they said, current burdens must be justified by current needs. The Section 4, the data they were using to put states under Section 5, was 1972. So they essentially were using very old data. This at a time when black voting in this country is way up, minority voting in this country is way up and virtually everywhere. Some states that used to be considered the most racist in the nation have the most black officials now. So this law clearly had run its course. And Alaska found itself under Section 5 supervision when it failed to provide language assistance. The people didn't speak English as a first language, and that brought the state under that jurisdiction. The state, along with eight others, sued Shelby County, Alabama.
Recently.
Yeah.
They were part of this suit.
Right, right. So they sued. We kind of waited while they decided the Alabama case, and they did. The Voting Rights Act was enacted 48 years ago. It was for 5 years. It's been reinstituted four times, most recently in 2006. There was a lawsuit filed in the court in 2009, pretty much told Congress, we're not going to act on this now. We're not going to deal with these qualifications. But you guys have to straighten this out, toughen it up. Congress didn't do it. In fact, the last time they adopted to reauthorize it was for 25 years. It's kind of interesting. It was Fannie Lou Hamer, Rosa Parks, and Coretta Scott King Voting Rights Act. And Justice Scalia decided, well, you know, maybe it's just the chicken politicians decided they didn't want to get involved in this at all. And so they went ahead and authorized it for 25 more years. It would actually have run to 2030-something if they hadn't stepped in.
And at this time, how's this going to affect reapportionment here in Alaska? Do we know, or is it too early to know? I certainly know that who are on the side of the Democrats are deeply worried.
Well, the good news, I mean, this is not like, gee whiz, do whatever you want. You don't have to, there's still federal lawsuits to be involved. Justice Department can still get involved. It just has to prove its case now. It just can't go back and say, 1972 is this way.
Well, you have to go to court. You can't wait for court. The preclearance by the Justice Department to come in.
No.
Okay. I was going to add a few words here because I went to the library and did some research on this. And what's really striking to me, and what is true, is everything Paul said about the 1975 and the language considerations, that the state of Alaska was one of a number of jurisdictions all over the United States, including the Bronx and Brooklyn and other places, that were found to be not providing adequate materials to minority voters, in this case, Native voters in Bush, Alaska, to help them to vote. Providing if they didn't know English, they would be able to have information that would help them vote. The Times is full of information about the New York Times. If you go over and take a look at that, you can see that in detail. But what's so striking to me is that in 1970, we had a period of 15 years after statehood. And during that period of time, the people who controlled most of the levers of government, most of that time, the Democrats, who were Governor Bill Egan, Senator Ernest Greening, Bob Bartlett, Ralph Rivers, and others, majority of the time it was Democratic, they wanted those people in Bush, Alaska to vote. They wanted them to vote because they were going to be good Democrats. They were called the canoe vote by some people, who were going to bring in votes, and some Democrats would go to bed on election night thinking they were going to lose and they'd win the election. So it just strikes me as an oddity that Alaska wound up under this when for not doing a good enough job on and not having enough turnout. That was another problem. There were another criteria was areas, or they could be precincts, districts, where there were less than 50% turnout. And there was a lot of that in Native Alaska for a number of reasons. But it is odd to me that Alaskans, the Alaskan Democratic leadership certainly, would have wanted people to vote. It wouldn't have been like Mississippi, where they would have been discouraging them or stopping them from voting. In any case, Dacia, where are Anchorage's homeless coming from? You've worked on this story. Tell us.
Yeah, this is just a bit of information that I kind of tripped across when I went over to the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. I was talking with a researcher who did this one-day survey during their one-day Project Homeless Connect, where, you know, homeless folks come in and they feed them and give them a haircut and talk to them and gather information about them, try to figure out how they can help them in a variety of ways. They already knew that about 70% of the chronically homeless people in Anchorage were Alaska Native. But they asked them a new question actually last year, but they really didn't get to analyze the data until this year. They asked them, of the corporations, of the Native corporations, which region are you from? And they didn't want to know like the village. They kind of just wanted to know the region. And it turned out that they said number one was Chilista, number two, Bering Straits, and number three, Nana. And there'd been a lot of speculation about how rural to urban migration was playing into homelessness in Anchorage. And they feel like this new analysis of that data really validates a lot of anecdotal information that they had. And they hope that that information will be used to create more culturally relevant programs that can help Alaska Native homeless people
achieve stable housing. If we know who people are, we can do something for them.
Right, because there's the rural to urban issue. These are people that are facing that trauma, plus there's historical trauma that plays into some of the behaviors of the chronically homeless people in Anchorage.
Okay. Kyle, the saga of Wizard, this controversial sled dog that was involved in the mauling, may have finally reached its last stages.
Well, at least from the Matthew Burroughs standpoint, and from the standpoint of the dog, I mean, we're talking at about noon on Friday. I spoke to Animal Control Chief in the borough right before coming over here, and Wizard was still alive, but the plan was that he would be put down sometime on Friday. And that was at the request of the musher, of his owner, Jake Berkowitz, who issued a statement that you can read on his Apex Kennels Facebook page, saying that that they feel that the dog has been treated inhumanely, that it's a dog that's used to exercise, it can't get out. There is no end in sight in terms of kind of the legal wrangling with the borough. They also make some accusations about specifically about the dog's treatment at the borough that the borough has pushed back on. But at the end of the day, at the end of today, the dog will probably be put down by Berkowitz's own veterinarian. You know, what remains unclear is whether or not there will now be a civil suit. From the very beginning, if you read the animal control officer's reports from the day of the attack, from the very beginning, it's been clear that the family has kind of been asking about or thinking about a civil lawsuit, and their lawyer has not said whether or not they'll do that. But you know, that the specter of that civil suit is one reason I think that there was a hearing in the first place. You know, that we had this, what was kind of a strange, almost like death penalty trial for this dog, and it was because the musher wanted to get the facts of that day on the record and kind of both in the public court of opinion but just kind of on the public record. Here's what happened that day, because they feel that they were blameless in the attack.
Okay. Dacia, we have time for one final story, and it's a nice story. Access Alaska has a new building, and the new building is going to improve some people's lives.
Yeah, Access Alaska, they primarily help seniors and people with disabilities. They moved into the old neighborhood health center in Fairview. That was a kind of plain 1970s era building, you know, offices down the hallways, really traditional. And they totally remodeled it and made it completely accessible for anyone with a disability. So wide hallways, people in wheelchairs or with walkers can walk side by side with other people. They have Braille at the doorways. They have a special phone for people who have hearing disabilities. So it's pretty fabulous, and it looks great. I mean, it's really beautiful. It's kind of that, you know, industrial look with the open pipe and the high ceilings and everything exposed.
And how many people are going to be accommodated, do you know?
Well, they help, you know, people in so many different ways, but they help, you know, around 3,000 people a year in Alaska. People with head injuries, they said that they've had a real increase in veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, helping them with disabilities, head injuries, issues like that, and Alaska's aging population as well.
Hey, our show is aging. We're about out of time. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you after the 4th of July on Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.